The full title is The Resistible Rise of Arturo Uy. There's a word we don't often hear, resistible. You know, think of that T.S. Eliot poem, Stripes of Maculate Giraffe. Maculate? We think immaculate. How difficult it is to think of the opposite of a word that we only hear in the negative. The Resistible Rise of Arturo Uy is about how you could have stopped Hitler.
Yeah.
Fantastic play. Go see it. Okay. How we could have stopped Nick Clegg. Okay. Here's the beginning of a story. You all sitting comfortably? It would be laughable for me to doubt that any of my readers should be unfamiliar with Malastrana's foremost restaurant, that is, Steinitz's, the one in the first house past the bridge tower on the left, at the corner of Bridge and Bath Streets, the house with the large windows and the wide glass door, the only restaurant daring to occupy this most public of streets and opening directly onto the thoroughfare. That is why your Malastrana native, son of those hushed, subdued streets full of poetic nooks and crannies, does not frequent Steinitz's. It is frequented by functionaries, professors, and officers swept into Malastrana by fate, soon to be blown away again, as well as by a small number of pensioners and an occasional rich old landlord who has long since entrusted his livelihood to others. That is all. Half bureaucratic, half aristocratic. You've no idea what that is, because it's not in your book of Kafka. It's not Kafka, of course. That is the opening of a story in the Tales of Malastrana, which are usually translated into English as Prague Tales, by Jan Neruda. You're thinking, I know that name. Pablo Neruda, the Chilean poet, changed his surname by deed poll because he admired Jan Neruda, the Czech writer, so much. His name wasn't Neruda at all. I've forgotten what it was. We know Pablo Neruda, the great poet, as Pablo Neruda, but he took his name from the 19th century Czech poet, and Jan Neruda is the writer that the Czechs love. If you've been to Prague, quick show of hands, who's been to Prague? See, that's quite a lot already, isn't it? And you're only 13 years old. I was misinformed. But if you've been to Prague, you'll know that Kafka's face is everywhere, on every tea towel, every souvenir, mug, everywhere, isn't it? But if you talk to the Czechs about who they really, really adore, it's Jan Neruda. That story you just listened to the beginning of presupposes companionship between the writer and the reader. It presupposes that we both know our Prague, and we know the Malastrana, which is the little side. It's the side of the river across from the old heart of the city where the cathedral is. And it's the side that used to be, as it were, where the lowly people lived, in the shadow of the castle. And it's strangely intimate. It's got a very cozy feel to it. And it's quite a tourist beat, of course, nowadays. Think of that opening, and then think of the contrast with this. When Gregor Samsa awoke one morning from troubled dreams, he found himself transformed in his bed into a monstrous insect. I'm reading that from the translation by Malcolm Pasley. There are various translations, and they may translate particular words in slightly different ways. So don't let's worry about that too much, although there is quite an issue about the word ungeziefer, which is the word he translated as insect. The thing that has made Jan Neruda so beloved of Czech people is that he spoke to them in that companionly way. He reached out, as it were, to embrace people and bring them into the narrative. And he did it in Czech. And the thing to remember about the Czech language is that it hasn't been a literary language for very long. It wasn't a literary language, in fact, until the middle of the 19th century. And Jan Neruda's great merit is not only the quality of his stories, but also that he was the first writer to put Czech properly on the literary map. In the 1860s and 70s, that was when those stories were written, about 40 years before Kafka really got to grips with writing himself. Kafka wrote in German, and he often said that it was a matter of regret for him that he didn't write in Czech, because he was very conscious that he was living in a city, Prague, which finally had a sense of coming into its own as a city, as a culture, as a literary culture, an intellectual life. And he spoke and wrote in German. Just bear in mind something very important, and that is that German was the language in which Prague was ruled, the language of the governing and administrative classes, and also of the university, etc., not just for a couple of decades, but for centuries. You know, way back to when the Habsburgs had their court, the court of the Holy Roman Empire in Prague, way back, German was the language of Prague. And by the 19th century, that had become deeply problematic. Of course, those who spoke Czech have long resented it, but by the 19th century, by the rise of national feeling all across Europe, that was a problem. So there's Kafka in a really complicated position, because the other thing that you know about him, of course, is that he's a Jewish writer. He's a Jewish writer writing in German in the midst of the Czech people who are feeling this place is ours and we now have our literary tradition in the making. He regrets that he can't be more of a part of what's going on in Czech writing around him. And for that matter, his spoken German, which is that of one of the German classes of Prague, differs from that of people who come in from Germany to visit Prague. When professional people came in from Germany, they were rather condescending. It would be a bit like someone from Surrey affecting to take the piss out of a Yorkshireman because of his accent or something. It was that sort of patronizing that went on. People thought that there was something rather funny about the way that the Germans of Prague spoke German. And of course, for the non-Jewish German, they would look down on Kafka as a Jew. Haven't we just mapped out a starting position from hell? What a complicated position that is. Where does this man belong? Does he belong with this German minority who nevertheless have a stranglehold on the civic power of the city in Prague? Or does he belong with the Jewish people who feel themselves to be spurned by everybody? Does he belong with the Czechs in whose language he doesn't write? On every count, he's an outsider, isn't he? The story that you've been asked to read, which is translated variously as Metamorphosis, or The Metamorphosis, or The Transformation, or whatever, Die Verwandlung, the story dates from 1912. He began writing it on the 24th, I think it was, of November. So from where we stand now, he began on Wednesday. And he finished it, 3 weeks later? I think it's in the second week of December. I can check the dates. But anyway, it was quickly written in a space of about 3 weeks in the early winter of that winter of 1912. And it was published 3 years later in November 1915. By that time, Kafka was obviously no longer a beginner. at writing. He'd started to make a name for himself. He was only 10 years, well, by the time it was published, 9 years away from his own death. He died, as you know, as a relatively young man of tuberculosis. So this is someone who blossomed very quickly, found an extraordinary style and an extraordinary voice, a style which is robust and flexible and sinuous in the original German, as few other styles in German are, and told his great friend Max Brod that he wanted his work destroyed when he died. And Max Brod, all credit to him, said to Kafka's face, "You know that I will pay no attention to that instruction when you die." And of course preserved it for us, thank goodness. Kafka is one of the defining writers, not just of the 20th century, but he's one of those defining writers who transform entirely our sense of what writing does. Let me just read you a sentence of George Steiner's. This is from his essay, Humane Literacy, in the collection Language and Silence from the mid-60s. "He who has read Kafka's Metamorphosis and can look into his mirror unflinching may technically be able to read print, but is illiterate in the only sense that matters." What does Steiner mean by that? Of course, what he means is that this is a piece of writing which isn't just a flashy bit of stuff about someone turning into a bug or whatever. Because once we've done the creative writing workshop and we've said, hey, let's think about what happens if we turn into a cockroach or whatever it might be, then if we really put our minds to it, we can think about some of the rest, about leaving a sticky trail across things that we climb over and all those wiggly little legs, and what happens if you break one, and what happens if you learn how to drop from the ceiling without hurting yourself, and finally you get put out in the dustpan. You know, all of the thoughts in themselves are not thoughts that we couldn't have. But there's something more going on here, isn't there? There is a radical, deep inquiry going on into the nature of what it means to be human, what it means to be alive. This isn't creative writing. This is something more. This is someone rethinking the nature of the self. So when we read that first sentence, that he woke up and found himself transformed into a monstrous, whatever word we use for Ungeziefer, insect or similar, the first thing that we reflect is that this person who was a human is now something that is not human. The word Ungeziefer translates literally as vermin. Excuse me. The word vermin is what's known to the grammarians as a non-countable noun. We can't say a vermin or one vermin. Yeah? It exists only as a plural concept or a collective concept, I should say. Yeah? So it's non-countable. So the translator into English does not have at his or her disposal the option of saying that Gregor Samsa found himself transformed into a monstrous vermin. So we need to decide what sort of vermin might be meant by the German word. And Kafka doesn't give us a lot of help. In fact, he's very clear about this, because the publisher in Prague, Wolf, he'd made it, he'd got himself a very, very important literary publisher, offered him a drawing that an artist for the publishing house had done. And this drawing showed essentially a kind of little fly. And Kafka said, no, we can't have that. It's too specific, and I don't want anything that shows what the Ungeziefer is, because that has to be left unclear. If you have anything on the cover, just let it be a sort of a distant picture of the interior, maybe with the mother and sister somewhere standing there, that sort of thing, something generic. So he didn't want any clear impression of what the creature was. From the way that his movements are described and his sense of his body as a transformed thing is described, we have an understanding that there is some sort of a carapace on the back, don't we? So a carapace such as a beetle or a cockroach or something like that might have. So there's that. There are numerous legs. We're not given a count. We know something about a trail of stickiness or slime. So there are one or two clues, but nothing that's specific enough for us to be able to say it is this. And when the charlady who comes into the room and addresses him as a, in the English translation, dung beetle, that's not actually meant to be taken literally, because someone who lives messily, lives in a pigsty. Remember, there's this point where they call, at the very beginning, when the manager or chief clerk, depending on your translation, when the father calls through the closed door and says, he doesn't mind if your room's a mess. Do you remember that little moment of father-to-son diplomacy? So we have this mental image that maybe Gregor's room is normally a bit untidy, or perhaps a sty. But nonetheless, the word in German, Mistkäfer, is the word that the charlady might have used for someone who just never learnt to be tidy and was always living in a heap. So it's not really right to think that that translation you may have of the Mistkäfer as a dung beetle actually means that he's been transformed into a dung beetle. So in other words, even that is not to be understood necessarily as telling us what kind of vermin he's ended up as. So there are some issues about what the creature is that he's been transformed into, but the other way of thinking about this, and this comes later in history, is that Ungeziefer, of course, was the way that the Nazis routinely referred to the subhumans that they were taking to the extermination camps. They were vermin. And vermin is often, not only in the German language, used as a way of dismissing the humans that we think of as subhuman. So the word has been chosen very carefully by Kafka for a generic connotation. He didn't have to hang around for the Nazis to know how that kind of word was used. That's very deep in humanity, isn't it? So here's a word, Ungeziefer, that puts us as readers already onto a sort of a wrong foot, because it puts us alongside those who might use that sort of word. Well, maybe it doesn't. But it's one of the problems of the way the narrative voice works, because it reaches out and includes us, but it doesn't do that the way that Jan Neruda did it. Because that opening paragraph of Jan Neruda's text was about including the reader in the writer's experience and saying that we both know about this kind of experience, what Steinitz's restaurant is like, who goes there, and so on. We know what it's like. It's a collusion of that sort. Whereas the way that the narrative voice in Die Verwandlung, in Metamorphosis, involves us is very, very complex and uneasy, isn't it? It brings us in very intimately into the action so that we almost feel that we're inside Gregor Samsa's experience of the transformation. Yeah? And yet, of course, it's in the third person. So in that respect, we're still outside it. And as third-person narratives do, it invites us to take, to some extent, a detached perspective of what's going on. And by the use of particular strategic words like Ungeziefer, it's enforcing a kind of detachment. We're probably no more keen on having vermin in the place than his mum and dad, or for that matter, the three lodgers later, one of whom threatens legal action. So he's been made into a thing of the sort that we don't like to have around the place, and sooner or later somebody is going to say, we have to get rid of it. And it happens that in this narrative, the person who ends up saying those words is his sister, which is odd at first glance, because Grete is the one who begins by being the one who looks after him. She presumably is the one who sets out the bread and milk after the metamorphosis has first become apparent, and then she tries out the different kinds of food. You remember the cheese that he himself said last week was disgusting, or whatever he said, you know, we can't eat that. Suddenly there it is for the thing himself to eat. And in due course, Grete, the sister, is the one who says, we have to get rid of it. It. Okay, the self, somewhere in there, he still thinks that he is himself. But what is that self, if to others it has become it? And all of his experiences have been so completely changed, so that now he ends up with an apple embedded in his physical substance somewhere. Clearly he is not the same self he started out as, somewhere just before the story began. All of this is embedded, isn't it, in everyday reality. We know the name of the street, all of the little names that are given to us, not many of them, but they're drip-fed in a way that we hardly notice. Even the name of the sister comes into a bit of instruction that the mother shouts. They're dropped in. We're never told in a sentence the sister's name was Grete. You know, Kafka's not a clumsy writer. But he gives us the name of the street, the Charlottenstrasse, sort of in passing. But we actually have a lot of realistic information in the course of this story. Much more than we think at first glance. So we know, of course, about what's outside the window, that there is electric street lighting. There's a hospital across the road. We know about the picture that he's clipped from a magazine and framed and put on his wall. We know the kind of doors opening, those double doors which you still see in lots of homes all over Europe, in Austria, France, wherever you go, you'll still see those easily enough. So many details that we have. This is something which we very easily forget. George Steiner draws attention to that as well. With time, it has become obvious that much of Kafka's trans-realism, his edging of reality out of focus, so as to produce the economy and logic of hallucination, is derived from a precise, ironic observance of local historical circumstance. Behind the nightmare exactitudes of Kafka's settings lies the topography of Prague and of the Austro-Hungarian Empire in its decline. And more of that. And if you think of the castle, and if you've been to Prague, then instantly you know the problem of making contact with anybody in that castle. Even as a tourist, it's hard enough to find the way in, isn't it? The detail is present in Metamorphosis, but in a sense, it's entirely secondary, isn't it? It's of no interest. And our question is, what purpose does it serve? And the answer, of course, is, in a sense, a very simple one. Because if we're to think about what a transformation like this might mean, we've got to somehow or other believe in things that connect it with us as readers. There's got to be enough of that there. So there is enough interior, there is enough about the napkins at the breakfast table and so on. There's enough of this detail to make it credible, tactile, palpable, real to our understanding of what realism is. And the funny thing is, isn't it, that that appearance of realism is extended to the experience of the thing itself into which Gregor Samsa has been transformed. So the physical experience of having to maneuver himself out of his bed, somehow having to come to terms with being this new shape with these funny legs in unanticipated places, the whole business of acclimatizing and getting used to a new physical self, that is done with almost literal-minded realism, isn't it? It's a kind of hyper-realism, so that you want to scream at the man, stop it, we know he's got a lot of legs, don't go on about them. But he's busy rubbing the creaturely nature of this verminous creature into our faces, so to speak, isn't he? He's saying, look at this. Would you want to find one of these under the bed? Would you want to find one of these next to your plate at dinner or in the spaghetti bolognese? No. So the hyperrealism is being applied at the very point of the narrative where, in a sense, we don't want it, which is the point which is going to most emphasize the implosion and vanishing of selfhood, where the human vanishes from the human experience and becomes an alienated thing. That process, of course, has been at the heart of thousands of analyses of this story. I've touched upon the way that later the Nazis used that word Ungeziefer to speak of the people that they were going to annihilate. And of course, as a Jew in a city, Prague, which was almost at the vortex of some of the Nazis' endeavors, one could say, it's tempting, naturally, to begin by reading Kafka in that light, about what it says about the 20th century's history of dehumanizing the human. Another way is to look at it from a Freudian perspective. Remember that when the English translations of this appeared just after the Second World War, Freudian psychology and psychoanalysis were at their peak of popularity. And so the analyses of this story that were written at that period were all full of the ego and the id and the struggle between them for which would be dominant in the human process. And when we read the commentaries that the critics have produced, and I have to say that they are all in different ways absolutely defensible. That is the intriguing thing about this story, that it can be read, of course, in so many ways. The one thing that is gloriously missing, and this is going to sound really weird. Hello?
I'm really sorry to interrupt. Can we have a quick couple of records in the room? But okay, the charity.
Go right ahead.
Thank you. Is there a David Levestian here?
And amid all of the was that because I started in mid-sentence? there's a wonderful moment. Gosh, now whose life was this in? Probably somebody, Barry, at the back there, you might know the answer to this. Is this Heidegger's life, where after 1945 he's allowed to lecture again? You're nodding, it's Heidegger. And he begins his lecture by saying, as I was saying when we were interrupted. You've obviously understood what he meant, okay. Meaning when the Nazis prevented him from continuing his teaching. Okay, so as I was just saying, there are many, many grim, existentially unsettling interpretations of Kafka's story. Of course there are, because it's a terrible, terrible story. But the thing that is conspicuously missing is a reading of the story in terms of its, wait for it, humor. Now, don't worry, I'm not going to lose the plot completely. I'm not going to make a big case now for this being a masterpiece of comedy, because I don't believe for a second that it is. But do you know the thing that is really strange? When Kafka got together with Max Brod and some of their other literary friends in Prague, and he read the story out to them for the first time, they were on the floor in stitches. They thought it was the funniest thing since... Ooh, heaven knows what they thought was funny. But they thought this was hilarious. You know, and I go through the story at times and I think, what were they laughing at? Is it the departure of the fellow from the company? That little description of him running off as if he had scorched the soles of his feet. Is there something in that that is very slapstick to an Austro-Hungarian Empire sense of humor? Or then when Gregor has gone into the dining room and the mother is so upset by the sight of him that she fails to notice that the coffee pot has been upturned and the coffee is pouring out all over the carpet. I nearly shat. It is an extraordinary thought that this could be thought of as really side-splittingly funny, but apparently they were beside themselves with laughter. And you read that and you think, well, actually, maybe in a funny way, maybe we've got this all wrong. There is our fellow Franz, the young chappie around town, who always seems in the photographs to be just on the point, doesn't he, of breaking out into the biggest smile you ever saw, ear to ear. He looks like essentially a jolly chap who has a hard time looking serious for a photograph, doesn't he? And you think, there he is carving out a responsible career for himself, making his life in the workers' accident insurance. Oh, the poor bastard. Doing his duty. And you know, earlier this year, by which I mean 1912, his dad, and he doesn't have a flawless relationship with his dad, and later on he'll write his famous letter to my father, or as it says in German, letter to the father. One can't do that in English either. And when he writes that, he has all sorts of problems with his father that he unpacks. And earlier in 1912, he had this big argument about, oh, God knows what, about an asbestos factory and how to clear up some sort of problems that they were having there. And his sister, his favorite of the three sisters, Otla, took his father's side. She betrayed Franz and took the father's side. And look, on top of that, at the very time that he started writing this story, Felice, this is the woman that he kept on getting engaged to but never got round to marrying. Felice hadn't been writing to him for days. So he was quick to feel let down. Remember, there were no mobiles, no text messaging. Everybody sent each other a letter a day, right? So he's feeling let down. But the thing is that he wants to let off steam. And maybe he conceived of all of this as just a big kind of farce. It's possible. Maybe he read it to Brod and the others that evening to be understood as farce. But actually, no, I don't believe that either. Because what he wrote to Felice when he was writing it was that it was eine ausnehmend ekelhafte Geschichte, an absolutely revolting story. And I think that bit, that rings true to me. Because I think he knew very well that this was something that was going to disgust something at the very center, the very core of us all. This is existential revulsion at its ultimate, isn't it? That there is no self anymore. That what we think of as the self has been replaced by a thing that excites deep feelings of disgust, which one will call it and which one will get rid of in the dustpan. Many of the critics have pointed something out which is rather odd. Martin Greenberg puts it like this in The Terror of Art. He says, the climax is in the very first sentence. And the more you think about that, the more true and the more bizarre it becomes. And what a narrative challenge that poses to a writer. Now, if you're used to thinking of the title in terms of metamorphosis, you're also perhaps used to associating Ovid and the metamorphoses that happen to girls running away from gods and they get transformed into reeds or laurels or heaven knows what, or maybe into birds or whatever. And there are lots of other kinds of metamorphoses in Ovid's great, great book. And if you think about those narratives, then of course the metamorphosis in question comes, if you like, as the denouement. That is the point at which the story takes its extraordinary twist, and lo and behold, we have something changed. And we tend to think of change as being a kind of climactic thing. And that's deeply embedded into our hardwiring, I think, as a linguistic species. Think of being changed into a dead thing. That is the climax or a climax of tragedy. Or being changed into a thing that will be licensed to be together and reproduce. That is the model of comedy. The movement of comedy is towards lovers getting each other. Change we think of as being the thing that comes at the end. So it's actually a very profound thing to say by Greenberg and the others, that the change comes at the beginning. The climax is at the beginning. And Greenberg describes the narrative structure of this story as a kind of continual winding down from that point. And if you think about it, he's absolutely right. Because unless some magic happens and the transformation is reversed, there is nothing that lies ahead except what? Except a gradual accommodation of the family to these new circumstances, and of course the death of the thing that used to be Gregor Samsa. And when we put it like that, we notice that the story is actually about two transformations, isn't it? It's the transformation not only of the hero, if that's the word for him, who loses his identity, loses his selfhood, but it's also the transformation of the family. Now, it's very easy to pinpoint that with the father. Do you remember this passage where Gregor's reflecting? I don't know if I need to read this out, but he's reflecting on how the father always used to be lounging around in bed when he went off to work in the morning, and when he came back in the evening, there he was in his slippers with a dressing gown over him and so on. And now, on the other hand, he cut a fine, upright figure, dressed in a tight-fitting blue uniform with gilt buttons, of the kind worn by bank messengers. His heavy double chin spread out over the high, stiff collar of his jacket. From under his bushy eyebrows, his black eyes sent out alert and penetrating glances, etc., etc., etc. So the father, from being somebody who'd apparently more or less given up on himself, has become spry and energetic, full of new life. We know quite a bit about the family circumstances. We know that there was a disaster or a crash. We know that they must have lost a lot of money, that the father had to do something about it, that Gregor, as a commercial traveler, is essentially the one who in recent times has been bankrolling the family. His money it is that will, with any luck, send Greta to study music at the conservatoire. His money it is that the father has been able to squirrel away into the savings. Gregor, as a bug or whatever, hears this, didn't know that it was going on, the secretion of savings, but he approves it from his new vantage point. The family was living one kind of life, which had a sort of logic and rhythm to it. But by the change in Gregor's existence, they have apparently been delivered into a new kind of life. The father gets a new burst of energy. Greta seems to realize that a woman can actually fend for herself. She gets a job, she's a sales girl, and you might say that working on the Tesco checkout is no great shakes. But apparently beforehand, she was devolving the responsibility for her own life to somebody else. She was living off Big Brother, so to speak. They even have what looks like a kind of a soiree with the lodgers. Now, admittedly, the soiree is ruined, firstly, because Greta is not much of a violinist after all, and secondly, because Gregor makes his appearance in his new shape and rather ruins the evening for everybody. But we see that the family is transformed, and the point of that is made very powerfully after Gregor's death, at the end of the story, when they go out for their little outing in the tram, and the emphasis is very pointedly placed upon the youthfulness and the potential for marriage of the daughter of Greta. So at the end of the narrative, what was has been swept up and put into the bin. What is can be celebrated, because what is points forward into what will be. And we're being reminded that if something goes wrong, people will always go to the cemetery, the crematorium, or in Gregor's case, the dustbin, and they'll say a few words, but they'll busily get on with their lives. And they will think of themselves, and they will think of what may come, to which they can look forward with hope. I'm not saying that in my own voice, as it were. I'm deriving the moral that is in Kafka's story at that level. Because the moral is, in its own way, rather bleak, isn't it? Bleak, but good in equal measure. The good side of it is that where there is potential for life, humanity must always look first. And that's what they do in this at the end. And the bleak side of it is that very quickly, when things go wrong, humanity finds a way of making excuses to itself and no longer bothering too much and actually wishing that the darn thing would turn up its toes and not be there anymore. Yeah. So looked at like that, what we have in this story is, on the one hand, grim about selfhood, which is a very contingent, endangered, fragile thing. It's also grim about collective identity. The collective identity of the family unit operating within the larger unit of society is there to uphold the fiction that everything will turn out for the best, that things will go on. Yeah? The firm, the business for which he worked, will presumably continue. The clients, the customers will place their orders. Sooner or later, Greta will get married, etc., etc. So the existing order will be upheld. This story is often referred to as a parable. I'd just like to leave you with the thought that that may or may not satisfy you as a word for it. Because if we think parable, what do we think? It may be that if you had a Christian upbringing, your first thought is of Jesus Christ. And you think of, what should we say, the Good Samaritan. And here's someone who's been set on by thieves and is left in a bloody heap at the side of the road. And along come three people, and the first two pay no attention because they've got their own agendas in mind. Society has its own business to get on with. Individuals have their own business. They pass by on the other side of the road. And the third one, the Samaritan, stops, puts him on his beast, takes him to an inn, says, give him what he needs, I'll pay the bill. Looks after him, doesn't let him die by the wayside. And we listen to that parable and we think, oh, yeah, well, that's not difficult. And the whole point about Christ's parables, of course, is that they should not be difficult. If they were difficult, that would defeat the object because they were designed to be easily and readily understood. That's their point. They deliver a moral message very unambiguously. They're not there only for people who come to Warwick University. I'm going to suggest to you that parable isn't the right word for Kafka's story. Because we don't get to the end of it and we think, okay, here's a little box, this is what it means, I can tick that box now, the message is simple. And I suspect that that's a reason as well why it's had this compelling hold on us now. It's not just the extraordinary mastery of the narrative, it's not just this phenomenal, weird approach to realism. It's not just the sense that it gets, which touches every one of us, that the self may not actually be there at all, or at least not be what we think it is. But it's also that it just won't lie down. It won't let us put in the pin and say, that's what you mean. This is a text that is going to stay with you. Once you've read it, you're going to keep on going back to it, and you're going to keep on finding that you've no idea, really, what it means. Okay. Thanks, everybody.